until January 1944, Amory advised, for the government of India to have a fighting chance of procuring all the grain it needed from nervous cultivators, it would require another 50,000 tons of wheat by the end of December and a promise of the same quantity for each of the following 12 months. Leathers having already asserted that providing such quantities were out of the question, Amory concentrated on getting at least 50,000 tons for each of December, January, and February. The day before the meeting, the prof wrote to the Prime Minister. The quantities suggested are very small as compared with India's total consumption of over 4 million tons a month, he stated as usual. Given Wilson's September memo, he had to know that the argument was specious. Such imports might have the effect of thwarting hoarders, but surely enough had been done toward that end. Strong propaganda designed to discourage hoarding can be based upon the shipments we have already decided to make. He continued, "This shortage of food is likely to be endemic in a country where the population is always increased until only bare subsistence is possible. In such circumstances, small local shortages or crop failures must cause acute distress. After the war, India can spend her huge hoards of sterling on buying food and thus increase the population still more. But so long as the war lasts, her high birth rate may impose a heavy strain on this country, which does not view with Asiatic detachment the pressure of a growing population on limited supplies of food." Chilwell's argument was based on the famous proposition by the Reverend Thomas Robert Malthus, who in 1798 postulated that humans multiply faster than their means of sustenance, which meant that premature death must in some shape or other visit the human race. Those peoples whose lack of sexual restraint caused them to reproduce recklessly were especially prone to what he called positive checks on their population. These unhappy constraints included war, disease, vice, and the last, the most dreadful resource of nature, famine. Malthus's doctrine inspired no less than Charles Darwin, whose magnum opus on the origin of species is subtitled The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. Because more individuals are produced than can possibly survive, there must in every case be a struggle for existence, Darwin wrote. It is the doctrine of Malthus applied with manifold force to the whole animal and vegetable kingdoms. The entwined world view of Malthus and Darwin provided an explanation beguiling to Victorian elites, not only for the evolution of species, but also for the ordering of society. The evolutionist will not hesitate to affirm that the nation with the highest ideals would succeed, mused Savrola, a romantic hero that Churchill had created in the late 1890s during his sojourn in India. Conversely, an excess of compassion could perpetuate the debilitating characteristics of defeated peoples, imperiling the greater good. An 1881 report by the Government of India on preceding famines concluded that the poorest Indians were the worst affected by such calamities, and if relief measures were to prevent their deaths, they would continue to breed, making the survivors even more penurious. Death might even come as deliverance to those that nature had chosen to discard. Churchill had corroborated Malthus's perspective, writing of an 1898 Indian plague, "A philosopher may watch unmoved the destruction of some of those superfluous millions whose life must, of necessity, be destitute of pleasure." In truth, Indian famines of the Victorian era cannot be fitted into Malthus's framework, because he did not envision a worldwide grain trade that would enable the people of certain nations to consume far more or far less food than they could produce. Throughout the 19th century, Indians were harvesting enough grain to feed themselves, but the export cycle had drained grain surpluses and driven food prices beyond the reach of the poor. Great Britain, in contrast, produced far less grain than necessary to sustain its people, but was free of Malthusian constraints on its population because it relied on imported food. In short, to use the language that economist Amartya Sen would introduce in the context of the 1943 Bengal famine, the vanishing purchasing power of exchange entitlements of some sectors of society, having been pitted directly against the far greater entitlements of others, resulted in starvation in India. In his memo to Churchill, Lord Cherwell suggested that the Bengal famine arose from crop failure and high birth rate. He omitted to mention that the calamity also derived from India's role of supplier to the Allied war effort, that the colony was not being permitted to spend its sterling reserves or to employ its own ships in importing sufficient food, and that by his Malthusian logic, Britain should have been the first to starve, but was being sustained by food imports that were 6 times larger than the 1.5 million tons that the government of India had requested for the coming year. The memo did raise the prospect that harm would be inflicted on long-suffering Britons if help were extended to over-fecund Indians. At the War Cabinet meeting the day after the memo was promulgated, November 10, 1943, the Prime Minister gave his own Darwinian twist to Cherwell's Malthusian considerations. Amory made his plea, following which Winston, after a preliminary flourish on Indians breeding like rabbits and being paid $1 million a day by us for doing nothing about the war, asked Leathers for his view. In his pronouncements over the years, Churchill had invented some wonderfully apt animal metaphors, with rabbits the least among them. A communist such as Stalin resembled a crocodile. When it opens its mouth, you cannot tell whether it is trying to smile or preparing to eat you up. After a coup had done away with the pro-Axis regime in Yugoslavia, he said Hitler was in a more vicious mood than a boa constrictor, who had already covered his prey with his foul saliva and then had it suddenly wrested from his coils. The Prime Minister declared that while facing Italian forces in the desert, Britannica was an old lion with her lion cubs at her side, one of which may have been India, or at least its warlike aspect, the army. Gandhi had once been a tiger, but he had long since descended the food chain. More often than not, the small, brown, fangless and numberless Indians whom the frail old pacifist personified brought to Churchill's mind a prey species. The British lion, so fierce and valiant in bygone days, so dauntless and unconquerable through all the agony of Armageddon, can now be chased by rabbits from the fields and forests of his former glory, he had warned during the 1930s campaign against native self-rule. During the Quit India uprising, the government had the rebels on the run. Winston Churchill, the quintessential lion, was an excellent shot when it came to rabbits, and earlier in the war was heard to repeatedly murmur the first 2 lines of the ditty, "Run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, run, run. Run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, run, run. Bang, 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 bang goes the farmer's gun. Run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, run, run." The prey's role is to nourish the predator, and the predator's role is to keep the prey from overbreeding. Lions do not feed rabbits. In the War Cabinet meeting that November day, Leathers said that he could do nothing to assuage India's hunger that December. He could, however, manage to send 50,000 tons for each of January and February, and that was agreed upon. As it happened, Canada had offered a free gift of 100,000 tons of wheat to India to relieve the famine, and Viceroy Wavell had accepted. Churchill had already rejected Canada's proposal because, according to a document with the Ministry of War Transport, it would be unjustifiable to impose any additional strain on our shipping resources, especially if that involved seeking further shipping assistance from the Americans, for the sake of the wholly uneconomic prospect of shipping wheat from Canada to India. But a Canadian ship of 10,000 tons had become available at Vancouver, and Prime Minister Mackenzie King wanted to fill it with wheat for India. To Amory's consternation, Leathers and Churchill were vehement against this and resolved to stop the consignment. I can only trust that they won't have begun loading before Winston's telegram arrives, Amory recorded. The trouble is that Winston so dislikes India and all to do with it that he can see nothing but the mere waste of shipping space involved in the longer journey. At the time, a consignment of 9,000 tons of rice from Brazil was on its way to Ceylon, and shiploads of Australian wheat were circumnavigating India on their way to the Balkan stockpile. Other ships were travelling to Argentina to collect wheat for Britain, a trip twice as long as that to Canada or the United States, and as it happened, the United Kingdom already had more than enough wheat. I hope that out of the present surplus of grain you will manage to do a little more for the domestic poultry keeper, the Prime Minister directed the day after this meeting. If their hens could get more grain, Britons would get more eggs. Even as the War Cabinet debated the Bengal famine that November, representatives of 44 nations were meeting in Atlantic City, New Jersey, to hammer out the details of what would become the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration, UNRRA. India was represented by its Agent General in the United States, Sir Girija Bajpai, and by a gatecrasher named Jagjit J. Singh, a six-foot handsome Sikh from Kashmir, according to Time magazine. Singh was an entrepreneur and head of an immigrant association, the India League of America. He had earlier sent a report on the Bengal famine to Eleanor Roosevelt, who had passed it on to her husband. "This is a matter which the new UNRRA can properly take up," the president had responded. But a key U.S. representative to the UNRRA, the diplomat Dean Acheson, stated that India was not eligible for aid. Singh protested that surely the starving in Bengal qualified, given that the organization's charter promised relief of victims of war in any area under the control of any of the United Nations. The British representative, Colonel John J. Llewellyn, announced, however, that India was not a victim of war, and its case was not taken up for discussion. The leftist commentator, I.F. Stone, approved Singh's effort to give the issue of famine an airing. "I have found general agreement among officials dealing with shipping that it is nonsense to talk of a shipping shortage in connection with food for India," Stone wrote. "With some 50 million tons available, much of it inadequately utilized, a few hundred thousand tons of shipping could easily be allocated to ease the famine." The problem, Stone felt, was politics. Shipments made under pressure from public opinion would imply embarrassing admissions in British domestic policies, revive hopes of American interference in India. It was an issue on which Americans of both political parties could come together. Carl Mundt, a Republican congressman from South Dakota, met Singh and became infused with passion for his cause. Speaking in December before the House of Representatives, Mundt accused the UNRRA of harbouring a malevolent bias against a patient ally. "How did it make sense to feed former enemies and starve a friend?" he asked. His appeal fell on deaf ears, so the congressman coached Singh on the tactics of lobbying on Capitol Hill. After a vigorous battle in February 1944, the two managed to win over enough Democrats to insert an amendment to the UNRRA bill extending benefits to any area important to the military operations of the United Nations which is stricken by famine or disease. All that effort was in vain. The War Cabinet did not permit the government of India to apply for aid, a necessary formality before it could be sent. British authorities did, however, donate $30 million of the colony's wartime earnings to the UNRRA, making India the sixth largest contributor to the fund. An UNRRA allotment of grain to India would have brought to the fore a discomforting question. Who would ferry it to Bengal? As Amory noted, the UNRRA itself was not in a position to provide any shipping. Had any grain been sanctioned, the ships would have had to come either from the United States or from the British Empire. The War Cabinet did not intend to request further shipping from the Americans, nor would it slow the build-up of its stockpiles by releasing ships or grain. Throughout that autumn, the United Kingdom's civilian stocks of food and raw materials continued to swell, so that by the end of 1943 they would stand at 18.5 million tons, the highest total ever. The United Kingdom imported that year 4 million tons of wheat, grain and flour, 1.4 million tons of sugar, 1.6 million tons of meat, 409,000 heads of live cattle, 325,000 tons of fish, 131,000 tons of rice, 206,000 tons of tea, 172,000 tons of cocoa, and 1.1 million gallons of wine for its 47.7 million people, a population 14 million fewer than that of Bengal. Sugar and oil seeds overflowed warehouses and had to be stored outdoors in England under tarpaulins. American and Canadian grain traders complained that excessive British demand was distorting the market and worried that, after the war, the United Kingdom would use its vast stocks to manipulate world prices. Why was such a stockpile necessary? The U-boat threat had fallen away, the tide of war had turned, and a plethora of ships were available. Hitler still could and would launch airstrikes on the United Kingdom, but the Blitz had shown that almost three-quarters of the supplies directly affected by bombing could be recovered. Air attacks threatened lives, not food supply. That fall, ships were being diverted to bring equipment for Operation Overlord, the invasion of northern France that would be launched from British soil, so it made sense to keep some extra stores at hand. But the quantities being held were far too large to be explained by the prospect of that attack alone. The War Cabinet's preoccupation with domestic stocks was in fact motivated by the economic shocks that would follow the fall of Germany. In October 1943, Churchill had informed the public that the government was preparing for the end of the war. The first of the urgent needs of the post-war period was to plan for smooth demobilization, and the second was the provision of food for our island on a scale better than the wartime rations. Historian R.J. Hammond has noted that the Ministry of Food's estimates of minimum required stocks increased in tandem with actual stocks. For instance, whereas it had stated 850,000 tons of wheat as the minimum working stock in 1943, the ministry set the figure at 1 million tons in 1945 and represented this as a reduction from a supposed wartime minimum of 1.2 million tons. The stated minimum for oil seeds similarly swelled. What purported to be an insurance against a breakdown of distribution was in reality something that could hardly be avowed within the Ministry of Food, and certainly not at the Combined Food Board, where Americans were all too eager to dissect British stock levels, namely an attempt to protect the future level of United Kingdom consumption, Hammond wrote. In November 1943, Viceroy Wavell circulated a memorandum that explained to the province's governors why no aid could be expected for Bengal. The Ministry of Food expect a world shortage of cereals, and although the shipping position has improved very greatly, the Ministry of War Transport has to consider not merely the tonnage available, but its operation as part of the general strategic plan. Thus, though food grains may be immediately available in Australia or North America, the Ministry of Food may be reluctant to release them, and the Ministry of War Transport may be unable to deliver them to India except by diverting ships and changing loading programs on a scale sufficient to be most embarrassing. In other words, the harvests of Australia and Canada were being regarded as part of the United Kingdom's strategic stockpile and were being conserved for post-war use, as had been recommended during the War Cabinet meeting of January 5, 1943. Shipping difficulty cuts both ways, the Minister of Production had declared at the time. It means that we are piling up stocks overseas. An undated S-Branch memo noted that Colonel Llewellyn, who succeeded Lord Woolton as the Minister of Food near the end of 1943, was demanding a minimum stock of 12 million tons of wheat, presumably in the British Empire as a whole. That amount would be easy to achieve, given that at the end of 1943-44 harvest year, stocks will amount to about 29 million tons, assuming no relief shipments to liberated areas. Still, the memo continued, it was somewhat excessive to regard 100% of the volume of trade to the free world as a necessary minimum stock, given that 7 million tons would be ample. The extraordinary quantity of wheat stocks that the Ministry of Food regarded as essential militated against even a few hundred thousand tons being expended on famine relief in Bengal. Another reason for the paucity of aid, as Wavell had explained it, was the risk of loss of face. The diversion of a large amount of tonnage to India would possibly have been most embarrassing, because it would have proved to Americans what they had suspected all along. The British had extracted a lot more shipping than they really needed. When the US President and the Prime Minister met that November in Cairo, much of the talk was about the demands of the post-war world. The Americans wanted to treat colonies, such as those of France, as trustees of what would be a newly organized United Nations. For the time being, the colonies would remain under imperial control, but would be coached toward independence, and inspectors would visit from time to time to gauge their living conditions and political progress. Churchill refused outright to subject the British Empire to such an order. The conference continued its work in Tehran, where the Soviets joined in. At a tête-à-tête with Stalin, Roosevelt cautioned that it was unwise to bring up India in the general discussions, and Stalin agreed that this was a sore spot with the British. Sometime in the future, the president continued, he would like to discuss India at length. It would, he said, probably require Soviet-style reform from the bottom. Stalin opined that the colony was complicated by culture and caste, but that reform from the bottom meant revolution. The Bengal famine was reaching its climax, even as the world leaders met, but it appears not to have been mentioned, which is odd, given that the economics of India were discussed at some length. The US military had conquered a number of Pacific islands and was determined to establish a chain of bases there. Because the islands themselves would be under international control, the president saw no contradiction in establishing such bases under the aegis of the trusteeship scheme. Stalin agreed that footholds near the Axis powers would be useful. Suspecting that the two Allied leaders sought some of the Empire's possessions for these bases, Churchill angrily retorted that the British intended to hold on to what they had, and nothing would be taken away from England without a war. This extraordinary threat must have been directed at the President, who was displaying the most inclination to do away with old-fashioned colonies. Sometime during the conference, Stalin baited Churchill, accusing him of cowardice because of his foot-dragging on the invasion of northern France. "What happened?" he teased. "Is it advancing age? How many divisions have you got in contact with the enemy? What is happening to all those 2 million men you've got in India?" At one vodka-soaked banquet, Churchill was needled by Stalin so mercilessly that he stomped out in a fury. On December 16, at a meeting of the War Cabinet that Churchill did not attend because of illness, Leathers mentioned that Canada was pressing very hard to allow at any rate one shipload of Canadian wheat to go to India. News of the offer had leaked in both the Indian and the Canadian media, and the political now perhaps outweighed the shipping aspects, said Leathers. To Amory's relief, the War Cabinet acquiesced to a proposal to load a Canadian ship with wheat for India. In late July, the Government of India had requested 500,000 tons of wheat to be delivered by the end of 1943. That amount was the minimum necessary for maintaining the army and the most essential war workers until the next harvest. Apart from the psychological impact of imports on hoarders, who would take substantial grain imports as a signal of falling prices and thus release grain to the market, thereby causing prices to fall in reality, the needs of rural India had not figured into this calculation. In response, The War Cabinet had authorised 130,000 tons of barley, which was of little help, and 80,000 tons of wheat, the first shipments of which reached India in November. The paucity of relief meant that for the rest of that year the soldiers and war workers in India continued to consume grain that might otherwise have been used to relieve the suffering of the people. The famine came to an end in late December, when the survivors harvested their own rice crop. According to Chitto Samonto, some in Kalikakundu died of diarrhea because they ate the creamy rice seeds long before they had had a chance to ripen. Winston Churchill's true love was war, and it took precedence over such dreary matters as colonial economics. The chief of the Imperial General Staff, Alan Brooke, had a full-time job restraining him from headlong pursuit of whatever glittering military prize had caught his eye. It is a wonderful character, the most marvellous qualities and superhuman genius mixed with an astonishing lack of vision at times, and an impetuosity which, if not guided, must inevitably bring him into trouble again and again, Brooke mused in his diary. Perhaps the most remarkable failing of his is that he can never see a whole strategical problem at once. His gaze always settles on some definite part of the canvas, and the rest of the picture is lost. This failing is accentuated by the fact that often he does not want to see the whole picture, especially if this wider vision should in any way interfere with the operation he may have temporarily set his heart on. Churchill overflowed with ideas for operations and hated the lull that preceded a major undertaking. In the autumn of 1943, soldiers and supplies were being gathered for Operation Overlord, and precious little was left over for supposedly quick and easy side ventures that could turn into quagmires. Yet one day, the Prime Minister would be pushing for an attack on the Balkans, a few days later on Sumatra or Norway, and in another week he would be back at the Balkans again. He is in a very dangerous condition, most unbalanced, and God knows how we shall finish this war if this goes on, Brooke wrote in October. The previous year, Brooke had turned down the Middle East command so that he could stay in London and prevent the Prime Minister from precipitating another Gallipoli. Churchill may also have had that disaster in mind when he had appointed Brooke the Chief of Staff. That is, he may have been aware that he needed containment, while recognising that of all his generals, Brooke alone had the personality for that task. "When I thump the table and push my face towards him, what does he do? Thumps the table harder and glares back at me," Churchill had said admiringly. After tremendous and exhausting battles, to which he brought the full force of his conviction, lungs, vocabulary, and lacrimal glands, Churchill would eventually back down and accept Brooke's judgment, only to return to the fray the next day. When it came to civilian advisers, however, the Prime Minister had picked too many cronies, whose sycophantic counsel on the Indian famine he would rely on rather heavily. "All I want is compliance with my wishes after a reasonable amount of discussion," the Prime Minister said of the War Cabinet, and he was only half joking. Lord Woolton, Lord Leathers, and Sir Percy James Grigg owed their positions to him and deferred to him. Lord Beaverbrook, who served on the War Cabinet in a variety of positions, was an old friend and ally. Brendan Bracken, the Minister of Information, once circulated rumours that Churchill was his father, so enamoured was he of the older man. Bracken would personally present to Churchill preview copies of ministers' speeches due for broadcast by the BBC. One minister was shifted from his post because he intended to say that members of Parliament did much that was asked of them, but refused to shout, "Hail Churchill!" As for Cherwell and the S-Branch, their allegiance was unabashedly to Churchill alone. "Churchill on top of the wave has in him the stuff of which tyrants are made," Beaverbrook had once warned. Lord Moran, Churchill's doctor, similarly noted, "When the sun shines, his arrogance, intolerance, and cocksureness assume alarming proportions." Ever the bumptious schoolboy, the Prime Minister may also have relished thumbing his nose at Leopold Amory, his lifelong rival and critic. "Churchill is instinctively inclined to disagree with anything I say," the Secretary of State for India had observed 2 years earlier. Despite never having been to India as an adult, Amory was a far more knowledgeable and legitimate adviser on the colony than was Churchill. Yet Amory was also long-winded and incapable of expressing himself dramatically. He had little hope of seducing the Prime Minister with the kind of catchy epithet Churchill relished and respected. The prof, in contrast, knew exactly which buttons to push. The problem was that whereas Brooke served as a restraint, Churchill acted as a goad. Lord Moran commented that the prof's placid appearance deceived many who met him casually. Once they got into conversation with him, men learnt with a start of surprise that the most violent views were hidden and disguised by the level tones of the prof's voice. In a 1960 lecture at Harvard on Churchill's wartime influence, physicist and writer C.P. Snow would say of Churchill's chief adviser, "He was formidable. He was savage." Snow complained that Churchill's advocacy of area bombing of German civilian houses had prevailed over the objections of other physicists. The prof's close relationship with Churchill had given him more direct power than any scientist in history, Snow argued, and power so unchecked was harmful. Churchill did question Churchill's judgment on one occasion when the scientist dismissed evidence that the Germans were developing a rocket capable of damaging London. Yet the prof never wavered in his personal devotion to the Prime Minister. The only other individuals of whom Churchill was heard to speak admiringly were Albert Einstein and Lord Birkenhead, his biographer's father. Churchill believed that a small circle of the intelligent and the aristocratic should run the world. "Those who succeed in getting what everyone wants must be the ablest," he asserted. The prof regarded the masses as very stupid, considered Australians to be inferior to Britons, advocated harshness toward homosexuals, and thought criminals should be treated cruelly because the amount of pleasure derived by other people from the knowledge that a malefactor is being punished far exceeds in sum total the amount of pain inflicted on a malefactor by his punishment. Inferior as the British working class was in Churchill's view, he nonetheless ranked it far above the black and brown subjects in the colonies. A measure of his racism can be found in his assertion that 20% of white people and 80% of coloured were immune to mustard gas. The figures are clearly incorrect, because biology admits of no such chasm between the races, but they are in keeping with early 20th century notions of eugenics. Eugenic ideas also feature in a lecture that Lord Churchill, then known as Professor Lindemann, had delivered more than once, probably in the early 1930s. He had detailed a science-based solution to a challenge that occupied many an intellect of the time, preserving for eternity the hegemony of the superior classes. Any attempt to force upon nature an equality she has never admitted was bound to lead to bloody strife, the scientist asserted in a draft of this talk. Instead of subscribing to what he called the fetish of equality, he recommended that human differences be accepted and indeed enhanced by means of science. It was no longer necessary, he wrote, to wait for the haphazard process of natural selection to ensure that the slow and heavy mind gravitates to the lowest form of activity. New technologies such as surgery, mind control, and drug and hormone manipulations would one day allow humans to be fine-tuned for specific tasks. Society could create gladiators or philosophers, athletes or artists, satyrs or monks, at will. Indeed, it could manufacture men with a passion and perhaps even aptitude for any desired vocation. At the lower end of the race and class spectrum, one could remove from helots, the Greek word for slaves, the ability to suffer or to feel ambition. Somebody must perform dull, dreary tasks, tend machines, count units in repetition work. Is it not incumbent on us, if we have the means, to produce individuals without a distaste for such work, types that are as happy in their monotonous occupation as a cow chewing the cud? Lindemann asked. Science could yield a race of humans blessed with the mental make-up of the worker bee. This subclass would do all the unpleasant work and not once think of revolution or of voting rights. Placid content rules in the beehive or ant-heap. The outcome would be a perfectly peaceable and stable society, led by supermen and served by helots. Because many people would evince an illogical disgust of such alterations to the nature of the human species, one might have to make do with great apes for such tasks instead of humans, the prof conceded. It would, of course, be somewhat more difficult to make an efficient bricklayer out of a gorilla than out of a bushman, but at least no one would demand votes on behalf of an ape. As for the unlimited number of half-witted children born of mentally defective parents, sterilization could and should ensure that society be freed of that burden. Philosophers have failed to agree on any definition of what is good, and what should be our aim is a matter of individual opinion, the professor summarized. But unless we desire to see our civilization perish, to see it disappear as the great eastern cultures of the Nile and Mesopotamia did, unless we wish to prepare for new dark ages such as followed the crumbling of the Roman Empire, the fundamental cause of present-day unrest will have to be removed. To consolidate the rule of supermen, to perpetuate the British Empire, one need only remove the ability of slaves to see themselves as slaves. Lindemann's utopia bears an uncanny resemblance to the science-determined dystopia that a contemporary writer, Aldous Huxley, brought to life in his novel Brave New World. And his talk of helots suggests inspiration from Sparta, a racially segregated city-state about which he would have learned in school. The prof may also have derived from ancient Greece the insight that hierarchical regimes are most endangered by those who chafe under their bonds. The Spartans once offered freedom to 2,000 helots who had performed bravely in war, and then killed all those who stepped forward to claim their liberty on the assumption that, as recorded by the classical historian Thucydides, they would be the most high-spirited and the most apt to rebel. In Lindemann's utopia, racial superiority alone would not win a high social ranking. He demanded intellectual superiority or aristocratic lineage as well. He envisioned a clique of exalted beings perched on top of a pyramid, with the rest of society ordered in caste-like layers beneath. The hierarchy resembles the terrifying society that George Orwell would sketch in his novel 1984, in which a class of elites uses mind control to rule over a society of commoners and, below them, so inferior and distant as to be almost invisible, slaves in the colonies. The objective of the three empires chronicled in 1984 was to arrest progress and freeze history at a chosen moment, wrote Orwell, so that this time, by conscious strategy, the high would be able to maintain their position permanently. This was the selfsame outcome that the prof hoped to deliver. Chirwell's utopia also recalls the predator-prey pyramid envisaged by Darwin, in which the king of the jungle forever reigns over forests and fields of scurrying rabbits. Chapter 10. Life After Death. As the longest year that Bengalis could remember gave way to 1944, the winter fields were golden with grain, but the villages looked deserted. When the sun rose each morning, survivors emerged from their huts to crouch on their doorsteps with vacant expressions. By afternoon, many of them had gotten malarial shivers, wrapped rags around their shoulders, and gone in to lie down. The malaria virus thrives on the enfeebled frames of famine sufferers, and an epidemic began, accompanied by outbreaks of smallpox and cholera. The people had barely the strength, let alone the will, to harvest the crop. A few hunted obsessively for loved ones from whom they had become separated during their wanderings in search of food. One resident of Kalikakundu, Buvan Samonto, made it through the famine but lost his mind. The villager is undoubtedly in an extremely nervous state, probably amounting almost to panic, Lord Wavell observed. Despite a bumper crop, prices remained high, and any attempt by the government to requisition the harvest would cause it to go underground, raise prices further, and give speculators an opening. In a bid to restore confidence, the Viceroy had undertaken to feed Calcutta using resources outside of Bengal, an effort that would require 650,000 tons of rice and wheat per year. On top of that, the colony was about to have to shelter and provision 20 divisions and 184 squadrons for a major attack on Burma. The expanded army, along with labourers employed on building roads and aerodromes, would require 1.1 million tons of grain. "I think Cabinet must trust man on the spot," Wavell informed Amory. "You can warn them from me that it is my considered judgment that unless we can be assured now of receiving 1 million, repeat 1 million tons of food grains during 1944, we are heading for disaster, both as regards famine and inflation." Lord Cherwell challenged Wavell's warning. "I do not think the figures presented stand up to examination, or that the case has been made out for taking anything away from the UK import programme," he responded. "If India were to receive wheat imports, it must then certainly export 120,000 tons of rice to Ceylon," he insisted. The new Minister of Food, Colonel Llewellyn, backed him up, arguing that world stocks of wheat would likely fall to a dangerously low level in 1945. More immediately, Australian wheat would be needed to feed Italy and the Balkans. Should those supplies instead be used for India, the Mediterranean region would require grain from Argentina, with a resulting increase in the strain on shipping and foreign exchange. On February 7, 1944, the Prime Minister refused to sanction further shipments to India on the grounds that imports into Britain could be further reduced only at the cost of much suffering. Instead, he created a committee comprising Cherwell, Leathers, Llewellyn, and Richard A. Butler, in place of Amory, who was sick, to study the Indian food problem. Wavell was not happy. "I warn His Majesty's government with all seriousness that if they refuse our demands, they are risking a catastrophe of far greater dimensions than Bengal famine." In response, the India Food Grains Committee sanctioned 50,000 tons of barley from Iraq. "I regard this as a matter of life or death for hundreds of thousands of Indians," Wavell responded. "The War Cabinet should either ask the Americans for shipping or allow India to appeal to UNRWA." He spoke to Auchinleck, the Commander-in-Chief in India, and to Lord Louis Mountbatten, the Supreme Commander of the Southeast Asia Command, who warned the Chiefs of Staff of a worse famine than last year, with obvious impacts on operations. They, too, urged an approach to the Americans, while Amory, who was suffering from a kidney stone, offered to fly to Washington and ask the president for shipping, if that was the only place where it might be found. The India Food Grains Committee reiterated that the British Empire stood outside the sphere of UNRWA activities, but the 50,000 tons of barley were changed to wheat. The army distributed quinine to civilians in Bengal to combat the threat of malaria, but it was a drop in the ocean. Exposure to the elements exacerbated the suffering from malarial fevers. The poorest villager never could afford wool for the cold weather, and during the past year, the single cotton garment that a man or woman wore day in and day out had fallen to pieces. "It is difficult to say whether there is more hunger or more nakedness in these parts," one traveller had written. Obviously, both these monsters were competing with each other, with the result that the corpses in the streets were often utterly naked. I saw a mother savagely resisting her child, trying to protect its naked body from the chill wind with a part of the rag she was wearing. Women could not go about nude, he added, but the torn and dirty rags with which they tried to hide their sex made them look many times more horrible than even utter nakedness. My mother and sister stayed inside or close to the house. Only we two brothers would go places, Chito Samonto confirmed. Ashamed of appearing unclothed before a father, brother, father-in-law, or son, many a village woman took to staying inside a room all day long, emerging only when it was her turn to wear the single fragment of cloth shared with female relatives. Some had to wait for nightfall to bathe or wash dishes, so that villages came alive after dark with shadows that looked more like ghostly skeletons than like women. A woman named Januki Bera of Kalikakundu lost her husband to the famine, but retained a small piece of land. A pair of local brothers, who were subsequently entrusted with distributing garments as a form of relief, got the field from her in exchange of a single sari, and later sold off the plot. During the war years, India produced 600,000 miles of cotton fabric, enough to girdle the earth 24 times. Out of this material, its workshops manufactured 415 million items of military uniform and 2 million parachutes used to drop supplies. Very little cloth was being released for civilian use, and most of that in turn was ending up in the hands of speculators. The armed forces also consumed India's entire wartime production of silk, used for man-dropping parachutes. Wool, used for 17 million uniforms and more than 5 million blankets, and leather, out of which was made 372,000 leather jackets, 16 million pairs of boots, and 5 million pairs of shoes. Whereas in the United Kingdom, civilian needs generally had priority over military ones, in India, civilians came last. In November 1943, Lord Mountbatten, the supreme commander of SEAC, asked Viceroy Wavell if the production of cotton parachutes could be doubled to 200,000 per month. A mere trifle for India, he said, as it only meant giving up 2% of total cloth. Wavell pointed out that 2% of India's population came to 8 million, which was quite a large number to go short of clothes. Nevertheless, India did produce 200,000 parachutes per month by August 1944. By enabling vital supplies to be dropped into the jungles of the eastern Himalayas, these parachutes would make all the difference in the last battle for the British Raj. In December 1943, the Empire's forces under Field Marshal William Slim began to hack their way through virtually impassable jungles into southern Burma. After a year of rest and training, the Indian Army was in good form. Slim had built up the morale of his troops by ensuring that they were well-nourished, well-protected, including by daily doses of quinine, and adequately bolstered in their fighting spirit by reports of Axis atrocities. Propaganda pamphlets depicted the Indian National Army of Subhas Chandra Bose as dupes of the Japanese, or JIFs, Japanese-inspired fascists. Engineers, explosives, and teams of labourers transformed precarious mountain passes into paved roads capable of carrying tanks, so that Slim's 14th Army broke through to a valley in the Arakan Peninsula. In February 1944, the Japanese commander in Burma began a counter-attack in the Arakan to draw attention away from the main thrust, which was to come in via Imphal Valley in India, north of the Arakan. After Axis forces broke through to India, the forces of Subhas Bose were supposed to enter their homeland, fight guerrilla battles, and inspire a national uprising. By that time, the Indian National Army boasted roughly 20,000 former soldiers and an equal number of civilian recruits, including 500 women of the Rani of Jhansi regiment. But their Japanese allies had issued them no real weapons, which required the INA to make do with rifles and ammunition that had been surrendered by the British 2 years earlier. The Japanese had, however, committed to hand over all the Indian territories they would conquer to a free government of India that Bose had set up. To that end, Bose had drawn up detailed administrative plans and printed currency and stamps. The INA's bard had composed a marching song in Urdu which began, "Step by step let's walk along, singing songs of happiness to the land our lives belong, we'll fight and fall upon its breast." "It is nearing 00 hour," Clive Branson wrote to his wife on December 4, 1943, from Chittagong. He was finally leaving for the front. "Always remember that one is given by fate only one lifetime in which to work and live for humanity. There is no greater crime, in my opinion, than to renounce the world, no matter for what excuse. If anything should happen to either of us, never say, 'It is finished.' What we miss we can only find in knowing humanity more deeply and not in the ever-narrowing circumference of private memories. And above all, whatever happens, let us never for one instant, on the slightest excuse, forget we are human beings and belong to the brotherhood of man." 10 days later, Branson was in the jungle. The little mountain villages near the camp were deserted, so he got to peek into the huts with their airy walls of woven palm and their carved beams. "Life here glides by like a falling leaf, so that very often I don't know either day or date, but I always listen to the news," he wrote. "The radio announced the end of the Bengal famine, but said nothing about the malaria," he commented, "or about the shortage of able-bodied men that made it hard to reap the crop." Once the soldiers went on an outing, and some of them shot a cow for the beef and took it away from a poor farmer without paying him anything. "It made me very angry," Branson related. At a distance from the camp lay a rice field, which cultivators were permitted to harvest during certain hours of the day. They had to gather a large bundle, deposit it more than a mile away, and jog back for the next load, which wore them out to the point of collapse. If they had not left the field by the military-imposed curfew, they would be shot. "I need not comment on the whole business," Branson wrote, "but it is the living result of poverty, plus peasant ownership, plus imperial army." At other times, Branson the painter would bathe in a stream or lie in the winter sun on its sandy bank, gazing at the creatures with whom he shared the earth. "I have just seen a little fish coloured black and yellow like a wasp. There are also other fish with horizontal lines for camouflage, also a number of fish constructed very like a lizard, a very long body which is curled up when they rest on the sand or on a rock. I have come across a common creeper with purple flowers, the leaves of which are in pairs. The colour when old is gold-yellow, when fresh, a green which goes golden when the sunlight shines through them. This creeper is the hunting ground of a yellow-gold butterfly whose wing shape is exactly the same as that of the leaves. Some of the men came across 5 graves of British soldiers, marked only by a beer bottle." On January 26, Branson wrote from a position closer to the front, "We are now only a few hundred yards away from glory." As he maintained the day's routine, making his bed, chatting or sleeping, mortars were screaming overhead. "Here we have such complete mastery in armaments of all kinds." The problem was that the Japanese had dug trenches deep into the sandy hills. "The bombers are just coming over. We climbed up on our tanks to have a grandstand view of 12 liberators and dozens of vengeance dive bombers exterminating the Jap positions. One of the men caught a green snake with a salmon-coloured patch behind its head, and Branson spotted what may be the smallest moth I've ever seen, white with blue-black markings on wings and light brown head." Field Marshal Slim described how after the bombers had flattened the Japanese positions, artillery took up the task and pumped shells from their accumulated dumps into the smoking, burning, spouting hillsides. Then the guns suddenly paused, and the Lee Grant tanks roared forward, the infantry bayonets fixed, yelling their Indian war cries following on their tails. Branson was a tank commander, and his platoon was soon to go on a dangerous assignment. He enclosed a sonnet, the last lines of which went, "Women and children build up the only road where overhead the shells of death whine past, and cattle graze indifferent to the din. I felt perhaps I'd understood at last by close observance of all that nature showed. When life has gone, then where does death begin?" At some point, Branson became ill and was flown to Chittagong to recover. There he met some Bengali communists with whom he had become friends during his previous stay in the city, and gave them two street plays that he had written, asking that they be translated into Bengali and performed. Shortly afterward, he returned to the front. On February 25, 1944, Troop Sergeant Clive Branson was killed in action at Nakiadak Pass in the Arakan. In March 1944, the Japanese began their main offensive, sending forces through the jungle to surround the 7th Indian Division at Imphal Valley. The bulk of Allied weaponry travelled to the front on the road that ran through Imphal. After it was taken, the Indian National Army was to trek down the highway in the other direction, into the heart of India. Bose had persuaded the Japanese commanders to accept 3 INA battalions for the attack. Colonel Shah Nawaz Khan led 1 battalion on an arduous hike through dense jungles and up to a height of 6,000 feet. The men lacked woolens, medicines, field radios, mortars, machine guns, and other essentials of warfare, and by the time they reached their destination, many were barefoot and a quarter suffered from malaria. Colonel Inayat Kiani, who led an equally ill-provisioned INA battalion north toward Imphal, sent 300 soldiers across the Indo-Burmese border. A Japanese officer recalled the men wild with enthusiasm as they walked on Indian soil, holding their rifles aloft and shouting, "Jai Hind! Chalo Delhi! Hail to India! On to Delhi!" The second chant having been the cry of the sepoys during the 1857 uprising. But they ran into an ambush, followed by enemy airstrikes and more infantry attacks. By this time, in the World War's Eastern Theatre, Japan was desperately trying to hold the line in the Pacific, and Burma had become a backwater left largely to its own devices. The attackers had meagre air cover and few tanks, and depended on a tenuous train of horses, mules, oxen, and elephants for such essentials as food. They trusted that once they reached India and acquired what they called the Churchill supply, all shortages would vanish. In contrast, the British Empire's forces in the region were bolstered by lend-lease tanks and aircraft from the United States, paid for with Indian supplies and services. Integrated SEAC operations, under the overall command of Lord Mountbatten, allowed American resources to be freely used against the INA. With Churchill's backing, Mountbatten diverted American Dakotas, planes that were ferrying supplies over the hump to China, to instead reinforce the garrison in Imphal. For a fortnight, food, water, and ammunition were delivered to them like manna from above, Churchill would write. An extraordinary airlift operation brought into the besieged valley the entire 5th Indian Division, which had returned from the Middle East and been retrained for jungle warfare. Gliders dropped 30,000 guerrillas behind enemy lines, the largest airborne operation in the war, according to Field Marshal Slim, whose combat was to be supported by tens of thousands of parachute drops a month. In the third week of June 1944, the Empire's forces broke the siege of Imphal. The Japanese retreated, with losses of more than 60,000 men. The INA battalions also fell back, their strength reduced to half, mostly by sickness. The monsoon had arrived, so that when Shah Nawaz Khan arrived at a flooded river and found no boats to cross, he had to leave behind 400 men who were too weak to ford it. It was Indian resources, and, for the most part, Indian troops, that had restored the honour of the British Empire. Most of the native soldiers killed without hesitation the compatriots whose intention it had been to make India a free country. Meanwhile, the Viceroy in New Delhi continued his uphill struggle to obtain food for Bengal, By March 1944, the government of India had procured only a tenth of its target of 1 million tons of rice. Still, the Food Grains Committee in London proposed an exchange. If India would send 25,000 tons of rice per month to Ceylon, it would get an equivalent amount of wheat beginning some months later. I really think they are crazy at Whitehall, or else they never trouble to read one's telegrams, Wavell vented in his diary. A fresh crisis loomed. The wheat crop was turning out poorly. If soldiers from the Punjab thought their families back home were in trouble, they would desert to return and rescue them. Beset by such worries, Auchinleck and Mountbatten offered to forego a tenth of the military equipment being shipped to India, or 20,000 tons per month, if the shipping space could be used to bring wheat. "I think the argument is now getting unrealistic once more," the prof grumbled, and reiterated his demand for a swap of rice for wheat. At a war cabinet meeting on March 20, 1944, Field Marshal Brooke urged that 200,000 tons of wheat be sent right away because not enough equipment could be found to fill the ships allocated to the military. Winston was obviously very annoyed, according to Amory, and protested that the armed forces were overstepping their constitutional boundaries. Brooke stood up very well over this. Winston then asked Leathers for his views, who made out as negative a case as he could. Amory warned the members of the War Cabinet of their responsibility if the result is going to be a worse famine than the last one. After a few monologues on the subject of the wholly worthless and possibly even dangerous Indian army, the Prime Minister agreed to Brooke's proposal. He could also send a further 150,000 tons of wheat, but only in exchange for the same amount of rice for Ceylon. "This is better than nothing, but it will make Wavell very angry," Amory sighed. Tom Wilson of the S Branch urged an appeal to the Americans. Even a refusal would be useful, he wrote, because if another famine should occur, it would be a good thing on political grounds to be able to say that we had asked the United States for help and that they had been obliged to turn down our request. But Leathers advised against asking the Americans, for they might actually agree. Then they would certainly take anything away from us which they gave to India in terms of ships. On April 6, 1944, an emissary from the Viceroy pleaded with the Food Grains Committee for Imports. Grigg, who was present, declared that the food problem had been largely brought about by Bengali merchants for political purposes. He insisted that it was the prerogative of His Majesty's government, not of the Viceroy, to decide whether the available supplies in India should be applied to supply the defence forces or the civil population. He and Cherwell suggested hanging some wealthy natives, presumably hoarders, in order to deter speculation in grain. "It was a packed committee," Wavell complained to Amory, "with that old menace, the professor, who knows nothing of India, or very much about anything else really useful, I should say, and Leathers, an interested party, intent on holding on to all shipping he can, and Grigg, who is always inclined to be mischievous about India." As Wavell described it in his diary, the committee had pointed to three options: A, to supply the shipping; B, to ask the Americans for it; C, to tell the Viceroy to supply the army's needs and let the Indian people starve if necessary, and had left the choice up to the War Cabinet. "I think they would adopt course C if they had any real hope that the Viceroy would consent to carry it out," commented the Viceroy. During these negotiations, the weather and bad luck intervened to make the situation more dire. Hail wreaked havoc on the wheat ripening in the fields of the Punjab, and an ammunition-laden vessel exploded at the Bombay docks, killing 500 people, injuring 2,000, and